Welcome to the Broken Pie Chart Podcast, episode 269. I'm your host, Derek Moore. With me is Mike Puck, Director of Business Development at Zega Financial. Jay, we gave Jay the week off this week. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good, Derek. Good to be back on again.
All right. So we're recording this and the market is open. It's kind of Friday. Pullback today. And, you know, it's official. We're greater than a 5% correction down. I think at one point it was minus 5.4% from the all-time high. I mean, we haven't had an all-time high since March 28th, Mike, like the, you know, batting down the hatches, right? But like, all right, we did it. We're in a 5% correction.
Correct. We are in a 5% correction. I think it's as of today. And like you mentioned, this is normal, though. These 5% pullbacks happen frequently. I think there are two to three times a year where you get that 5% pullback. And it's interesting because you start getting a lot of phone calls or you start getting a lot of people saying, hey, what's going on? Should we do a review meeting? And, you know, the typical answer is, or the answer what it should be is no, you know, these are just normal. These are healthy, normal pullbacks. You know, you're shaking the tree, letting the weak fruit fall. And, you know, 5% is a totally normal pullback. So nothing to worry about.
All right. So let me just put some context around this. And Charlie Bolello put out a chart on, I think it was Twitter. I forget where I found this from, but they happen a lot. Like typically you have corrections. I think I saw anywhere between 4.5, 5.5 times a year on average. But let me just read some of these to you. So I'm going to go back and let's see. 2012, minus 8.9%. Okay, so that's greater than 5%. Fiscal cliff concerns. Obama's reelection. April 2012, Europe debt crisis. You know, the market's higher. I just mentioned we just made a new all-time high. It was March 28th. All right, 2014, 15. December 29th to February 2nd, minus 5.4%. Falling oil, strong dollar, weak earnings. Look, we don't know what's going to happen. That's why we buy and we hedge. But the point is, like, these are normal. And I think sometimes when the markets have been going up and up and up, it's like, oh, what do I do? And investors like, what do I do? What do I do now? I mean, do they sell? Well, imagine if they would have sold every one of those times. And sure, they might have avoided some of the downturn. That's why we hedge. We hedge the downside. We simply do not know. And the other thing I'll tell you too, Mike, is last night I'm on Pacific time. So it was probably around, I don't know, 9 or 10 my time. There was some geopolitical stuff that went on. And the futures, the S&P futures, the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ 100 futures just dropped. I think at one point I saw the S&P futures just drop minus 1.7%. And it got me thinking, Mike, like, could you imagine if there was 24-hour trading? Like, think about last night, if that move happened during the day, would people have just started to sell? I mean, the market today, it's down, but it's down, you know, as we're recording this, a little less than 0.5%. But I think, right. I'm glad we don't have 24-hour trading, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, and there's some after-hour trading, right? So you can trade after 4 p.m. East Coast time, but a lot of things happen around the world while it's nighttime in the United States, right? So that would, if you were able to get up in the middle of the night and trade, that would probably be a bad thing because, you know, markets get volatile when something like the Middle East conflicts happen. And the truth is you shouldn't do anything during that. You might be down, you know, 600-700 points. I mean, I know after the election sometimes, you know, November, you might look at the futures overnight. Or first thing in the morning, market could be down significantly, but it doesn't mean you should panic. It's usually things kind of flatten out as the market opens. And today's a great example of that.
I mean, I look at this too, and it's almost by not having the markets open, it almost saves investors from themselves in a lot of ways. And it's not to say that we can't have moves like that during the day, but if somebody is in the markets and they're in the markets for the long term, it doesn't mean buy and hold, we say buy and hedge, but it's just a good reminder of, like, sometimes doing nothing is better. Doing nothing. Do less. What was the movie? They were in Hawaii, Russell Brand and the guy from How I Met Your Mother. And he was doing surfing lessons. Paul Rudd, I think, was doing surfing lessons. It's like, okay, do more. No, do less. Do less. Like, sometimes do less, Mike.
Right. Well, right. When you don't know what to do, don't do anything at all. Right. That's, you know, I think that's the quote. So, yes, again, if you're not sure what to do with the portfolio or Usually the right answer is don't do anything, right? Or on the other side is, you know, if the market's down significantly and you're not sure what to do, you know, what sometimes we see is that people just sell at that point because they're not hedged, right? They don't have the downside protected. So if that's something you're concerned about, then hedges is something you should think about, right? Because if you're worried that the market's going to drop 30% and your portfolio is going to drop 30%, well, that's a great example. Well, if I don't want to worry, I should hedge my portfolio, put in downside protection so that you won't experience that 30% drop, right? And like you said, you know, with all these different pullbacks that happen throughout the years, how do you know when that's going to happen? And the answer is we don't. You know, you could look at the smartest investors of the world and say, when's the next 30% pullback? And they do not know when it's going to happen.
Mike, you mean the people going on CNBC who say, I think there's going to be this or that? You mean they don't know everything? You mean they're not always right? Imagine that, right? I mean, come on.
Right, right.
Well, let's look that's at bonds actually, for a second, Mike, too. Ooh. I want to bring in, there sure. was a chart. Who is this by? This is B of A Research. And, you know, look, we use bonds in some of our strategies. For example, we have a buffered index strategy and we use some very short duration high yield in there. We'll talk about high yield later. But bonds are thought of as, you know, the quote unquote 60-40 portfolio. And everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but, you know, this is one of the things that people learn. Oh, I have stocks, I have bonds. One goes up when the other's going down. Not so much. This chart from B of A shows, you know, bonds hedge equity and the period when the most anti-correlation, maybe that's not the right, meaning bonds go up when stocks go down, is really kind of, if you look at maybe 97, 98 through, you know, 2021 probably, where you had that non-correlation. But if you look at 1945 through the beginning of the 90s, bonds and stocks tended to move together since inflation started. Bonds and stocks have moved together, meaning a lot of times what the fear is in the market is the Fed's going to relieve rates higher for longer. I've talked to that ad nauseum. The markets don't necessarily need lower rates to go higher. I don't know where markets are going to go. If you want to buy it, buy it. If you don't want to buy it, don't buy it. But the point here is that stocks and bonds move together a lot more, Mike, than people realize.
They do. Yeah, I think when you look at correlations between equities and fixed income, you know, they are supposed to be non-correlated, right? That's the idea of building that diversified portfolio, right? Whether it's 60-40, 70-30, 80-20, whatever that is. What you see is when the market has these big downward moves, and I think a lot of people saw this happen during COVID, also 2022, right? Things got very correlated in a negative market, right? It might have not moved one for one, but when the market has that big downward move, stocks and bonds acted very similar. And not just high yield fixed income, right? Even conservative fixed income happened. Like look at 2022, you know, the S&P 500 was down about 18%, fixed income was down 13%. Well, that's not much of a downside hedge or a correlation to or negatively correlated or no correlation to the equity market. So this is a great example, right? When markets turn negative, fixed income can turn negative too. It's not it's not going to offset in a lot of scenarios the equity declines.
So we look at this and you say, okay, I mean, 2008, someone looking at and saying, I get it. They don't always, one moves and the other moves. But it did work. You look at 2008, 2009, or 2008 especially, treasuries rallied when the market sold off. That was during a non-inflationary time. And I think the point B of A is making through this chart is when you have more of a higher inflation regime, they tend to be correlated. Now, we are seeing, speaking of rates, let's switch there. I don't know if you saw, Mike, now, actually, you and I talked about this earlier today, so you've actually seen this. I guess I could have just said, have you seen this and went with it? But anyway, 7.4% is the average mortgage rate. Basically, this is just a 30-year mortgage rate index. I don't remember who puts this out, but about 7.4, at one point it got above 8%. I don't know who's getting these rates, like if this is just the average, I'm not sure of that. But, you know, Mike, on this program, Jay and I have been talking for a while, like the Fed, by keeping rates high, are actually keeping inflation high in some ways, because if you are, I mean, it's doing a couple things. It's keeping the inventory low, the housing inventory that's available for sale. Because if somebody has a 3% mortgage, they're not going to move to go do, oh yeah, great, let me go do a 7.4% mortgage. But also it creates more demand for rents. I think the average year-over-year rent increase right now is about 4%, although some markets like Miami, I think, was more like 7 or 8%. Phoenix was more like slightly positive. But I bring this up because this is not what anybody thought would happen. The narrative coming into this year was the Fed was going to have going to cut rates, mortgage rates are going to go way down, and it hasn't happened. And I will also tell you that the spread, you know, if I look at the 10-year treasury, it's about 4.5%, a little bit above that. The spread between, meaning the price of the treasury and the 30-year mortgage yield, that spread is really wide. That's wide right now. And there's any number of reasons why that's happening, but this is not disinflationary, the fact that mortgage rates are this high, in my opinion. I don't know though, Mike.
Yeah, so I got on the Google machine here and just Googled on bankrate.com, and yeah, the 30-year fixed at 7.8% is the average right now, right? I think we're looking 7.4 to 7.8. So yeah, and that feels very high, especially compared to the past 10 years, right? When rates were 2 to 3%, and people were refinancing, or if you bought a new home, you had a really low rate. It certainly doesn't feel good comparatively over the past 10 years. To get that higher rate. And that's definitely driving up rental prices, definitely driving up well, you would think it would push housing prices down, right, Derek? But they're not actually on inventory. Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic, right? Typically when rates go up, housing prices go down, but that's not happening now, correct?
No, it's not, because who's selling a 3% mortgage? I mean, think about it this way. People who have a lower mortgage, and I forget the stats, X percent of the U.S. homeowners have a mortgage that's below, I think it was 4 or 5, it might have been 4%. Surprisingly, there are a lot of people who don't have a mortgage. Either they paid cash or they paid off the mortgage. So you've got this inventory and it's kind of locked right now. And, you know, I mean, even if you look at the late 70s, early 80s, they measured inflation different, but home prices did go up during inflationary periods. It is a weird dynamic, and you're right. The mortgage rate going up doesn't necessarily cause your home to go down. The question is, it's supply and demand. So I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. It's high, and the spread between the 10-year and the 30-year is high, is wide right now. And the Fed is obviously not helping this. I don't know. They're not going to raise rates, in my opinion, because the economy is doing fine. There's no reason to. And inflation is still elevated. Inflation is still higher than they'd like. But to me, correct. I mean, don't you think, Mike, like if they lowered rates, mortgage rates, what would happen to the housing market? Do you think we just see it take off again, or we just see this inventory free up and the market price we're at right now is the price? I mean, I don't know. We're not real estate investors.
Yeah. Well, what I'd say is, well, one thing, which this is a pat on our backs here, Derek, is I would say a year ago when we had the same conversation about mortgage rates and Fed funds rates and things like that, and what are they going to do, higher for longer? I think what you and I said was they don't have to lower rates anytime soon, right? So maybe we don't see the rate cuts this year, or maybe not till 2025. I think that's what voted for or thought that would happen. So, you know, they don't have to cut rates. I think inflation is still higher, and that's why they would cut rates, right? That's, they say, hey, inflation's under control. And I know that they come out and say, hey, it's not so bad, but it is a lot higher than it has been in the past when it comes to inflation.
I don't think they cut rates just because inflation goes down. I think they would cut rates because the economy is not doing well.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah. Look at the 90s, the late 90s. Interest rates were 5%. You used to get 5% of your checking account. I mean, that's gone. None of the banks are doing that anymore. But no, I think it's like my base case right now. Like I'm some analyst appearing on CNBC, you know, my base case. But I could see, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if they don't, there's no cut this year. I have no idea. What do I know? But it wouldn't surprise
me. I agree. I totally agree with you. I think there's some advisors and there's some investors out there that are saying, oh, rate cuts are coming. And I keep saying to myself, well, why? And you made a very good point, right? Is the economy in trouble? Is the economy stumbling? And the answer is no. If you look at the data and you look at all the jobs numbers that come out and unemployment rates, they're not giving a reason of why they would need to cut rates currently. And, you know, I still think banks are lending. Obviously, it's not as favorable as it was, but still, there's not really a strong reason to cut rates. So if you are looking for a house, maybe 7% is starting to look attractive, right? That's the other thing is people are going to start forgetting about those 2 and 3% rates in a few years from now and say, hey, 7's the new norm. Maybe we'll go out and buy a house at 7%.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of anchoring. And the same thing in stock investing, people get anchored to the old highs, you know, oh, or the old right. value of the account. You know, let's kind of triangulate this back, though, to the stock investor. So the reason why stock investors are fixated on rates is the belief, a couple of beliefs. One is if you are a fundamental analyst and you're doing discounted cash flows, and what that means is you're looking at the cash flows to companies or earnings in the future, you have to discount those back to the present using a discount rate. And so the discount rate is just a fancy way of saying, you know, what's the very short-term interest rate right now? Like use the three-month. So you say, well, you know, if I'm going to get a dollar in the future and I don't have it today, I have to discount that down to the present value. So that's one of the things. It's the idea of, oh, the lower the discount rate is, the lower the risk-free rate is, the higher, the more valuable those future earnings are going to be. Okay. So that's one of the reasons. The other thing is you look at something like small caps, the Russell 2000. Those are companies, a lot of those companies rely on debt. In fact, I haven't seen the stats recently, but there are a lot of companies in the Russell 2000 who actually don't have positive earnings. So that's another thing. That's where people are thinking, okay, well, I'd like to see lower rates because it makes the borrowing cost lower, the input cost lower, the maintenance of the debt lower. That's another thing. So you think about those, and then just on a competitive basis, I think a lot of investors are maybe out there and saying, I can get, you know, what do I think I'm going to get in my stock investments? And then what can I get risk free? And the more those right. narrow, the more people have to make choices. But I don't know. I mean, I just wanted to triangulate it back to investors. Like that's one of the ideas. So I don't know. We'll see what happens, Mike.
Right, right. Yeah. Like you said, it's the risk free rate, right? If investors can get, you know, X amount that with no risk versus what can the market provide for them, or what can this other investment, real estate or fixed income or whatever it is how much more than the risk-free rate can I get? And I think that correlates to, you know, what's going on in the stock market, right? Because if you get 5% in a money market account, which I've actually seen quite a few ads for that recently, specifically with Charles Schwab, okay, great. People feel comfortable with that. But what I will say is that 5% getting you inflation? Is that covering the inflation that you're experiencing? I think I just saw a study recently that said inflation, the grocery store was 21% over the past few years, the total inflation that we've experienced. Well, is that 5% you're getting at the risk-free rate, is that covering the 21% you have to you spend groceries on, that extra 21%? And the answer to that is no. I think that's also what pushes money towards the market, because people feel that they need more than that risk-free rate. So again, just spending more money and just not having a lot of reasons. I think the big takeaway for me looking at this stuff is, what are the reasons that interest rates would drop? And I'm just not seeing a lot out there right now, Derek.
Yeah, I mean, and if you're rooting for interest rates to drop, you're actually rooting against the economy. Mike, you had some data that you pulled, and it looks like recently, unemployment is still low. We know that. Wages are down, but it looks like, you know, wages are still growing.
Yes, correct. So, yeah, we did look at that specifically was the unemployment rates are low, right? We hear that number. I think the jobs number came out last week. Everybody was excited. It was a good jobs number again. Wage growth is down slightly from where it was last year. But it's still positive. Let's see, it's slightly above the average. The average wage growth over the past 50 years to be about 3.9%. Currently, this is as of February numbers, it's at 4.5%. So above where above the average on wage growth right now. So again, that's also a positive thing. You need wage growth to keep up with inflation. So we want to see that number higher. Higher is better. And again, that equates to people spending more money, going out, booking trips, going to airports. You and I always talk about, hey, what's going on in the airports? And they're still very, very busy, right? If you've flown recently, you know that people are spending money. So wage growth is up. Unemployment numbers are still very low. Again, all signs pointing to why would the Fed need to cut rates in this economic environment?
Let's move on from the Fed. I don't want to get too, but I will say, you know, wage growth and inflation, I always remind people when you see, oh, it's only 4% right now, but that's 4% on the new number. It's the new baseline. So, you know, I think that still is out there. Like when I talk to people around, you know, who I live around, or, you know, I think you're in, you volunteer too on, you know, within your community as well. Sure. And people are, you know, they look at what stuff cost, and a lot of people are like, look, stuff is double or triple what it was. Double or triple. So I don't know. All right, let's move on.
Right, right. One other thing here is the, I said, is the personal savings rate. That actually, so the numbers on that are well below average of what people are saving. So year to date, as of 2024, looking at about 3.8% is the personal savings rate. The average personal savings rate, let's see, back to 1960, has about 8.5%. So saving rates are down. Yeah, that goes back to spending money, right? And with the more money people are spending, the better they feel, the better the economy is kind of chugging along there. So, you know, saving rates are down for households. So just an interesting number. Again, that's not good for inflation, but overall good for the economy. And it just shows another area where, you know, when you tie in wage growth, personal savings rates, inflation, economic environment. I mean, this is all what's creating interest rates and keeping them where they are today.
I want to go switch to just the high yield market, high yield bond market. And I like to watch high yield because it's typically correlated with equities over the long term. And I watch it because some days when I see the market selling off or the market's going up and then I look at high yield, if one's not doing the same thing as the other, I say, well, somebody's wrong. And it's just, you know, it's a quick thing I look at. I have seen spreads in high yield start to rise. And what that means is, what is the yield to worst to the yield to maturity on a high yield bond versus that of a treasury? And early part, really since December, we've been hovering around that 3.2, meaning if you own a high yield bond, you get 3.2% more than you do in a treasury. And the yield to worst right now in the high yield index is about 8.3%. Those have started to rise. And so that is something to keep an eye on. And I'm not saying that, like, I don't know what's going to happen with markets or interest rates or all that stuff. We sort of, you know, just kind of talk through all this stuff like we would if we were having a regular conversation. But spreads are widening right now. I will tell you too, Mike, that high yield is interesting because if you look at the yield to worst, so yield to worst versus yield to maturity, here's a quick little lesson, folks. Yield to maturity says if you buy a bond and you assume that you buy it and you get your par value back and it doesn't default, so you buy it, whatever it is, you get $1,000 back at maturity, and then you get whatever the coupon payments are. So the combination of those, you kind of say, okay, the yield to worst right now, by the way, that's yield to maturity. Yield to worst is saying, let's look at the yield to worst case, which means you get called away early. There's call provisions on corporate bonds. So that's if you get called away early. So the yield to worst right now on high yield overall, the index is 8.3%. And that's an annualized number. What's interesting about high yield, and Mark over at State Street, I had a call with him this week, one of their bond strategists, and he kind of pointed out to me that, you know, the average time to maturity in the high yield index is much lower than it was in recent years. 4.8 years is the average time to maturity. It was over, it was probably 6.6 in September of 21. And so I bring that up because what that means is, and credit to Mark as well on this, it means that the sensitivity to interest rates on high yield bonds is actually lower right now. Like the risk to a change in rates is lower right now. So without boring most of the audience and going into how we calculate durations and interest rate risk, I just think it's an interesting thing. You know, the other part, Mike, and I know you've been following this as well, default rates really have not crept up in high yield. So for all the talk about any number of things, default rates are pretty low, right?
Correct. Yeah. So that's something to point out, right? We look at high yield quite a bit at Zega. We have some strategies that utilize the high yield bond market specifically. And so yeah, I'm very concerned about it, right? I look at it monthly, our investment committee meetings, you know, we look at positions in the high yield bond market. And it has done very well comparatively over the past 5 years, right? If you look at, they actually performed some of the best out of the fixed income market in general, right? High yield's not done particularly well. One of the things that we look at very consistently is default rates. So the long run average on default rates since 1990 is about 3.5%. As of March 21st, 2024, default rates are about 2.5%. So 1% lower than the long run average. So I think that's something to think about too. Again, thinking about the economy in general, right? So default rates on the high yield market are actually even lower by 1% than they typically are. So they're two-thirds what they usually are. So again, stronger economy. That these are all kind of good things here. And that's just, I think that's a very it's a very important number to look at is when you're investing in high yield bonds, what are default rates at? Right. If we started to see that go the other direction, 4, 5, 6%, right, higher than the typical average, that would be something to be worried about. That'd be something you'd want to be concerned with.
I think about defaults too. It's sometimes that, you know, some people call it a leading indicator because we start to see those creep up. Even if the economy, the numbers are still good, if the businesses and businesses who access high yield credits, you think about there's high yield, there's the loan market, there's high yield loan market. There is, this new thing with private credit as well. But you do see if those default rates, those are companies that, you know, those are lower rated companies. So if they start to default, that's kind of the foundation of the market there starts to crack a little bit. But I think it's smart to bring that up. And, you know, this is JP Morgan's guide to the markets chart. We like that, that guide they put out. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something to watch. So,
yep.
All right, let's talk commodities, Mike. Have you? I feel like this is the latest soup du jour. It's the latest thing to talk about, and the reason why is, you know, everyone's sort of trying to say, "Oh, wait a second, wait till you know commodities are up. Commodities are up. Like you know, what happens if commodity the input costs for all these companies? So producer price index is affected, and all these markets." Mike, this is one of those cases where I think if we, and I joke around with Jay a lot, I said, should we scare people this week or should we make people, you know, hopeful this week? Because if you do anything around financial news, it's like you can do one or the other. But I look at this and commodities, this is a Bloomberg Commodity Index, it's up roughly 7.7%, 7.8% off the early 2024 lows. This is a broad index of everything from energy to livestock to all, you know, you name it. But Mike, from the March of 2021 high, that's either March or July. I don't know, right? Maybe May. I think that's May, actually. Commodities as a whole are still down almost 25%. So this is one of those, if I only showed you the last 2 months, the chart would look like it's up and to the right. But it actually is still off the highs. I mean, this is something to watch because commodities, if the input costs rise, that will be inflationary. But yeah, I don't know, Mike, anything here? I mean, I feel like I've been seeing a lot of this stuff on either Bloomberg or CNBC. Like you hear people talking about, oh, we got to watch commodities.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let's look at some numbers here, because when a lot of people think about commodities, they think gold and silver. So I'm looking right now as year to date numbers as the taping of this podcast, right, is April 19th. S&P's up about 5% on the year. So that's a good start to the year, right? We're only 3.5 months in at this point. But I'm looking at gold specifically up 16% year to date. And silver is up 21.1% year to date. So silver's having a really strong start to the year. To your point, though, is that's a small time frame, right? We're looking at the last 3.5 months. If you look at commodities over a long period of time, over the past couple of years, well, they're down. They haven't really done particularly well. You know, every asset class has its time in the sun, right? Whether that's commodities or real estate, or private credit, all sorts of different areas, you can have a run where things do particularly well. And it seems like commodities are having their little run here, right? And they've been beat up for a while too, comparatively. So, gold and silver look good. I don't know if we look at like cattle and livestock and things like that, how they're doing. Oil has been,
Oil's been last few months. I mean, it's making a run. West Texas Intermediate is above 85 now, I think. But
I'm just looking at year to date up 20% too. So and I think you're feeling that at the gas pump. I filled my car up the other day and I was surprised at how expensive it was. And that's when people start paying attention, right? As all of a sudden their tank costs 80, 90 bucks, 100 bucks to fill up, and you go, whoa, what's going on? So
what are you driving? $90 to fill up your tank? Like, what's going on there?
Well, I got an SUV. Okay. So yeah, so to your point, commodities they've had a small run here. Every asset class has its time in the sun. Commodities are doing well. I think comparatively to the market's obviously massively outperformed over the past few years compared to gold, silver, and commodities in general.
By the way, just a want to mention, you said gold and silver look good. You're not saying to buy it. You're saying the chart looks, if you look at the chart, it's going up. Like we're not recommending anything here. So let me just throw that in.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is not a recommendation by any means. And I get that question a lot, right? From advisors and investors in general. It's just, what should we do here with gold and silver? We're not gold traders by any means. But people say, I have 1% or 2% of my portfolio in gold, and that's probably okay, right? But I just think they've been a big lagger for a while. They're having a good run here this year.
Let's, the thing with commodities too, Mike, it's interesting because, all right, commodities, if you bought commodities, this index, let's say, in March of 2020, it went up, it looks like about 100%, over 100% to the highs in 2021. And can I tell you that, sure, I'll bet you a lot of people didn't buy it in March of 2020 because commodities were really unloved. They went nowhere for probably at least a decade. But can I tell you how many people probably bought commodities near the top? They're like, oh yeah, it's done the best. And when we have inflation, I'm going to buy it now. Like it's really hard to try and time all this stuff. But nobody wants commodities when they're low. Everyone wants them when they're high. But I mean, I'm sure you know people too. They're like, oh, I think I should buy commodities right now because they're a good inflation hedge. Right. And they were down. They were down. Like the 2022, they were down. Think about that. And inflation was really high in 2022.
Inflation was up. Yeah, absolutely. It was a big conversation last year is, hey, should I buy gold and silver because of inflation? And, like I said, it was particularly down. I mean, I'm looking at the 1 year look back here. So this is one look back. So from April 19th to April 19th of last year, 2023, and the S&P majorly outperformed silver and slightly outperformed gold. So again, they have not been the asset classes in favor over the past year. They're just having a good run.
Mike, I like to point out, I do watch the shipping container rates. People can make fun of me. I don't care. they got to about 4,000 per 40-foot box, container box. So you think about what you see on a train, that box that sits on the platform of the train. And if you look at a container ship, they just stack, 10,000 of these on a ship. But the WCI composite container freight benchmark rate per 40-foot box, it had gotten up recently. I mean, look, it went up over 10,000 in 2021, still high in 2022. It had come back down under 2,000, went back up to 4,000 with the problems in the Suez Canal and the ships having to go around the Horn of Africa. It's 2,718, so it's off the highs. And this is something I watch, because if you are a company and you need to ship things, and think about all the stuff you order on Amazon, which has to come from other places, it's manufactured in China. This is important because it goes into the pricing, the end pricing to a consumer. So I thought it's off the highs. It's still elevated compared to the 2023 averages. That's it on containers, Mike. We don't need to spend too much time on it, but I'll keep watching it for the audience. They seem to like that.
I love the container chart here that you provide every year, Derek. It's great. I may use this in my presentation next week in California when I'm presenting to a group of investors. Just because I do have a smile on my face right now. I know you can't see me, but this is a funny statistic to look at, but it's very true. And this ties into inflation, and it really did kind of, it got really bad. If you ever look up a chart on container rates, this is exactly what happened during COVID, right? This was what everyone talked about.
Oh, you can't say that word.
This happened during the COOF, actually.
Due to the March 2020.
Due to the issues that happened in March 2020. You'd be very surprised if you look at container rates over the past 5 or 6 years, because they really did spike significantly. And then when they came down, and kind of more normalized, and then we had a little spike here, kind of the end of 2023 and going into 2024. So, yes, it is a very interesting statistic to look at, specifically when it comes to inflation and rising prices.
By the way, if anybody wants to read about the history of the container shipping box, a book called The Box, and it's How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger by Mark Levinson. There you go. I love the book. And it's really fascinating. I mean, if Jay was listening to this, you'd be like, oh, Mike let Derek talk about container shipping. But it's like, you had to standardize these, like the size of the box. Like, think about it, before the container shipping box was standardized, they would just load a bunch of stuff on a ship. And then if they go to a port and the stuff was in the back, they'd have to unload everything, go get it. And so anyway, there's a book for those people. All right, Mike, I think we had a listener question. You want to bring that one and if you want to read that, I'll answer that one.
Oh, okay. Listener question. All right. Here we go. So how do I tell the difference between the synthetic and non-synthetic options listed under the holdings?
Okay. So this is an option question, and, we do need to talk about the VIX and volatility. Remind me on that, but yeah. So Thanks for the question. And we got this from one of the listeners. We appreciate the emails. And, I think it's a new thing. We'll start to read listener questions. Derek.Moore@ZegaFinancial.com. DEREK.MOORE. @ Z as in zebra, E as in Eddie, G as in George, A as in apple. Financials up to you to spell correctly.com. Okay. So when you look at, if you're looking at a brokerage firm, or you're looking, say you're going onto Yahoo Finance and you're looking at a mutual fund or an ETF, and you see some option positions. Think about it this way. Options are not, they're not labeled as, this is a short put, or this is a long call spread, or this is a synthetic position. What makes the position is the construction of these different pieces. So for example, if you're long a call option at 50 and you're short a call option at 60, same expiration, same month, same underlying, you would say, okay, well, that's a long spread. And that's actually a long, some people call it a long bull spread or a long debit spread. But those individual positions will just simply be listed as there's a 50 strike call and a 60 strike call, and you'll see a minus sign next to it if they're short. Synthetics, by the way, is the reason why option synthetics, and we talk about a synthetic position, is because if, let's say, you look at owning a stock, you just buy 100 shares of stock, you'd say, okay, I have all the risk to zero by 100 shares of IBM or XYZ. Let's use XYZ, totally fake stock, at $100. Okay, worst that happens, it goes down to zero. best that happens, it goes to infinity. I've yet to own a stock that went to infinity. But if you think about owning a stock, risk to zero, unlimited upside. To synthetically create that same 100 shares of stock of XYZ at 100, one could sell a put and simultaneously buy a call. And what's the risk there? Okay, the short put has risk to zero. This position has, in theory, can go to infinity, although you're dealing with options, so you have expirations and maturities and things like that. But that's it. You won't see the difference. You'll just see the pieces, and it's how they're arranged or how they're put together that makes it one thing or another. So thanks for the question on that. And all right, Mike, let's talk a little bit about volatility. VIX has been elevated-ish, I guess we could say. If I take a look at the VIX, and of course the VIX is a measure of option premiums. How robust are option premiums? Versus, and specifically the VIX is on the S&P 500. Mike, I know you follow the VIX as well. You know, today, yep. And the market's not closed yet. Normally we record this after the market, but the market's still open now. Spiked to about 21.33, at least intraday as far as we can see. That is the highest it's been, it looks like, since October 30th, I believe. So yeah, Mike, I'd say the VIX is a little bit elevated. And what that means is option prices, so the premiums on option prices are higher than they've been. And some people call it a fear index. It's really just a reflection of you go up and down the option chain and what they are. But I think this, I mean, this was kind of significant, getting above 20. It's back down 18 and a half now. And right. I don't know, Mike, have you ever watched see the Fear and Greed Index on CNN? They put that out.
I have seen that before.
Yeah. But it's, look, it's elevated. It's elevated based upon, you know, compared to where it's been.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's been sitting around 14, right? So it's been particularly low. I mean, I think it got as low as, you know, 13 at one point. Even in the 12s back in December. So, you know, a VIX is a good indicator of just kind of what's happening in the market. And like you mentioned, that fear and greed index. And when it stays low for a long period of time, right, people kind of get complacent and think, oh, well, the market just kind of goes up. And they forget that, you know, markets do correct like they are currently. And when those corrections happen, the VIX usually spikes. That does affect the price of options, right? That's, you know, one of the major things, or, you know, time and volatility are kind of two things that we look at, as well as a number of other metrics to look at. But, you know, when we get these little spikes in the VIX or volatility, that usually pushes option prices up over time, especially if we have a longer dated option, right? Longer time, that can move that price around significantly because of higher volatility. So, you know, it all depends on what's kind of happening in the market, but we've seen a spike in the VIX, and usually I think it's a good thing if you're an options trader.
I mean, a lot of option traders, so I don't want to generalize too much, but yeah, a lot of option traders like higher volatility. So think about if you are a seller of options and volatility is higher, the premium you're taking in is higher. But it's also relative. So if you're selling options, let's say you're selling something that would be negatively impacted if markets went against you, you would say, okay, well, you sort of want, if you're a seller of options, you want volatility to drop because the options, the premium based upon the volatility will go down. Conversely, if you own options and you get a volatility spike, that's typically good. But as you said, I mean, you have to get the direction right as well. It's I have seen the near-term volatility. So thinking about the 10-day, 30-day implied volatilities, it's still pretty flat, meaning the shortest terms on, let's say, the VIX futures curve or just looking at implied volatility in options across the chain, going out a year versus 10 days, most, you know, in a normal VIX curve or a normal, let's say, implied volatility curve, you'd expect to see the shorter term options be lower. But really all that's happened is you've had this really flattening of the implied volatility curve. So I will mention too, Mike, that VVIX, which is sort of the VIX of the VIX, it's looking at option premiums on VIX options, which of course are on the future. that had, today it's back down below 100. And, that had spiked to last couple of days, actually spiked to about, above 110. That's something that I watch as well. We have a quant strategy that actually uses a lot of the volatility inputs. So those are things that we watch. But, just because the VIX is low doesn't mean it has to go high. But I think, just looking at a chart of VIX, Mike, we've had this sort of slow build higher. And then today we had that spike. Is that the top in VIX? I don't know. I'll tell you next week. I'll tell you in 2 weeks. But so far it's, it's the highest it's been since October.
Yeah. Well, I love that you're getting into the VVIX, right? Now we're really getting into the weeds, the volatility on the VIX. We do talk about this a lot in meetings, right, Derek, is just around volatility and kind of what's happening in the market. And you mentioned something too that I think is important, right? Are you long or short options, right? So if you're selling options and you want to sell when volatility is high, you're going to get more juice in there, more premium. If you're buying options and you're kind of depending if you're a long-term or short-term investor, you want to be careful too where the VIX is. So there's a lot to look at, and the volatility on the volatility of the market, I think, is just a kind of a funny one and an interesting one to look at as well. And we do use that in quant strategy. So vol's been low. I think vol's been low for a while now, and we're seeing a little bit of a spike. Absolutely. This week and this little pullback is pushing the VIX higher.
I mean, you had pointed out some research. I think this was in J.P. Morgan's Guide to the Markets as well. I mean, it's been kind of fascinating because you think about the Mag 7 stocks, and it's a mixed bag. Like Apple is in a drawdown, Tesla right. is in a drawdown. I mean, there's certain companies we saw today. I think the SOX index is close to down 15% off its all time high. SOX is the semiconductors. So some of these bigger stocks, not all of them had doing great year to date, even though the market was at all time highs. Mike, you look at value versus growth, and I think that's an interesting thing to look at. But you've also looked at some of the Mag 7 stuff. So where do you want to start on that?
Yeah. So, well, you mentioned Mag 7. So let's take a look at that. It's just an interesting metric to look at. And one of the headlines this week on CNBC, I saw it with my own eyes, was is Apple dead money?
Really?
It was a headline on CNBC.
We don't know what it's going to do, but right. It's like, if you want to get clicks, I guess you start saying it's dead money, right?
It's dead, right. Of course. I mean, Apple, probably one of the most widely held stocks in the world. And you got, is it dead money? And you know what? For covered call selling, Apple has been a great stock to sell calls on the past couple of years, right? Apple's kind of teetered around, I'd say anywhere from 180 to 200, kind of bouncing back and forth, trading at 165 today.
Great because it's been in a range, I think is where you're getting it. It's been in a range and selling covered calls has actually brought in additional income for those that were holding it and selling calls, right? Because it when you're in that range there, you just keep collecting the premium. Sure.
Correct. Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. When it's a range bound stock or it's in that range, it can be a good stock to sell covered calls on. So Mag 7 is experiencing more volatility, but like you mentioned, Tesla's really getting beat up this year. Apple is having a down year as well. It's done particularly well, but remember that brings a lot of volatility. 2022, Mag 7 was down 40%. Why the S&P 500 was down about 19. So you're, double the market with that volatility.
What was the non-Mag 7 down in 22? Do you remember?
Yeah. So S&P 500 non-Mag 7 or ex-Mag 7 was down about 8%. So again, those stocks can be good at times, but they bring lots of volatility. So you got to be careful. And again, that ties very much into what's going on with the VIX and the volatility in the market.
But that, I mean, last year, the Mag 7 was up really high, right? I mean, that was...
Yeah, really strong year. So 2023, Mag 7 was up 76% versus S&P 500 X Mag 7 was only up about 8%, and the S&P 500 was about 24%. So you definitely wanted to have it in your portfolio last year. It really helped out performance.
I mean, I feel like this year, though, the non-Mag 7 has carried a lot of the water. But also, I know we say, you know, the XMAG 7, which is essentially 493. Well, it's actually more stocks because you have two of Google. But I mean, Eli Lilly definitely was, you know, I mean, it's a pretty big company now on a market cap basis that's had the semiconductors have had a great run this year. So I feel like there's been rotation as to who is driving towards those new highs. And, you know, the other thing too is like value and growth. You watch this all the time. And I always say this, like, I feel bad for tried and true value investors who were like, you know, at some point we'll have our day. Like, at some point, value will outperform growth for a measurable time and a measurable amount. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like it started to have its day this year, but what's going on there?
Right. Yeah. So that's something I always talk about at least once a year on the podcast, which is just kind of what's going on with the value and growth market. And value investors, you're absolutely right. They've been waiting for their day, waiting for their day. They thought they were going to have it in 2022, 2023, and it just has not happened yet. So year-to-date numbers, this was through March, growth was up 11.4, while value was up about 9. So catching up. I think the big difference here is what's happened in the past few weeks and with this market correction here. And it's really had a significant pullback on value. So value's up about 1% or so, 1-2% so far with the past couple of weeks added in there, and growth still up about 7. So the value investors have still not had their day. I know if you look over 100 years in value investing, you know, usually outperforms, but it's been, you know, 10 years now. If I look at the 10-year annualized number, growth is outperforming there as well. So it's something that we look at very closely, or I look at very closely, and it's not happened. It hasn't flipped the other way. If you look at value versus growth and relative valuations, it's the same thing where value continues to look cheap. I mean, as we get into March here, value looks cheap compared to growth, but it doesn't mean that it's outperforming. Growth is still outperforming. I think that value's kind of kicked up, especially kind of dividend stocks, things like that, which a lot of times are value. They have started to perform a little bit better, but overall growth is still taking the first place award here.
The trouble with a tried and true value investor who is like, I'll never buy growth, I'll never, is the idea that cheapness, like it could stay cheaper than growth for a long time. Like we don't know what's going to happen. But the other, I don't know what they call it, what is it? The value trap, where they say, yeah, it's, you know, it's got a 7 PE, it's got to go to a 10 PE, or if, you know, if it even gets to 70% of the growth PE, we'll have this. And sometimes it just, it's like a couple of years ago, we were looking at international deep value and the P's were something like, you know, 4.5. You're like, well, it seems like that's pretty safe. And then it goes to 3.5. You know, stocks go down further. So I feel for the value investors. I understand what they look at, and all the arguments they make sense. And I'll tell you what, I mean, if you listen to the arguments, you're like, yeah, no, that stuff is pretty cheap, but you just don't know. You don't know what people are going to buy. And then, you know, growth and the S&P as a whole, last year, the earnings were fairly flat, but the multiple, you know, what people were willing to pay on a future multiple basis went up. So I don't know. I'll let you know in 12 months, Mike. How's that?
Yeah, we'll keep you posted on the value growth story.
Yeah. All right.
The growth guys continue to perform.
Mike, any sort of recommendations? And you know, do you have any work done around the house? I know you gave an air conditioning company once on this podcast. Our Belgian listeners, you know,
very
love
local.
It.
That was a very local recommendation based on if you're a Florida resident. But no, I'm going back to shows here. I watched something over the weekend. I actually binge watched it, which was The Gentleman on Netflix.
Who's in that? I thought it was a great. Is that Matthew McConaughey?
Theo James is in it, actually, and a couple other folks, but okay. Not a lot of people I knew. Vinnie Jones is kind of a guy that I recognize, but it was actually a great show about a guy who inherits kind of like a kingdom. He's like a lord in in London, and it's a really neat show. He kind of gets himself in a lot of situations. And so, good show. I don't binge watch a lot of things, but I actually did last weekend. So I definitely recommend The Gentleman on Netflix.
The Gentleman. Okay. I just pulled it up. Okay. Yeah. That is new. 8 episodes. Is this a one-time thing, or is it going to be a series? I kind of like when it's a one-time thing.
It's definitely set up to have a season 2.
It's
for set, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. These are starting to run together, the podcast. I don't remember if I told the audience about the BlackBerry.
The movie.
Yeah, with the guy. He's a recognizable guy. The kid who plays the inventor of the BlackBerry. You've seen that? So I think it's on Netflix, yes. Right? Netflix or Prime?
You know what? I don't know if it's Prime or Netflix, but I saw the movie. Actually, great movie. It's really interesting how they follow the story and how the two guys built the company. It's a great story.
All right. So it's just called BlackBerry. Now I gotta look it up. What is it on? Do you ever use Just Watch? I'm probably getting like tons of ads because I feel like stuff just like pops up there. But if you go to Just Watch and you type in the name of something, it tells you what streaming services it's on. So I don't know if you ever used that.
No, I have not seen it.
It's tons
of, check it out.
A lot of ads though. Let's see. Oh, Hulu. I think it's on, is it on Hulu? I don't know. I have like every streaming channel. Like my wife asked me one day, do we have Peacock? I'm like, I don't know. And apparently we do. I must have been paying for that for a while. So
I think you're right. It is on Hulu, and which is on Disney now. Hulu's part of Disney. So you can actually, if you have Disney, you can watch Hulu.
It's pretty interesting. And Jim Balsillie, if you're I know you're not a hockey fan, although your Panthers, I mean, they could win the Stanley Cup, Mike, this year. You ought to go to a game in Florida.
This could be our year. I'm about an hour from the stadium. It's going to be well worth it if I go.
Yeah. I mean, get involved there. All right. I think that's all I had. I gave The Box by Levinson. If you want to read about shipping containers, I know me and probably 10 other people in the audience are interested in that, but it's a really good book. If you haven't checked that out, The Gentleman and BlackBerry. All right, Mike. Well, we made it. Good job. And, yeah, I mean, we'll see where this market goes. I feel like, I don't know. Like Jay and I have this running thing. I think I said the market would get to 5,400 before 4,900. I don't know how I'm doing. Well, it's back over 5,000 now. So we'll see. Who knows, right? That's why we hedge.
Yeah, that's exactly why we hedge. Well, tech's taking down the chin a little bit. A lot of things are in a pullback, but again, this is a normal pullback at this point, right? Nothing out of the ordinary has happened yet. So we'll see, but you're right. That's why we hedge.
That's why we hedge. That's why we don't know where markets are going. We just hedge. All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, Mike. Bye.
Thanks.